30B2.
Bakasha, it's BBC.
That's what?
BBC and NBC.
ABC and NBC, the BBC?
And it's very important, I couldn't find my way without, I'll find it, it's probably.
If you remember, the last subject that we found ourselves involved in was the subject of the Yetzer Hara. We have been reading about the importance of Torah study, and then Torah is the perfect drug, visamtem samtam. Torah is the perfect drug to deal with the perfect problem. What is the perfect storm that affects every human being, and that is the Yetzer Hara? Every human being has an inclination to do wrong, to do evil. And that's where we are now. We are on 30B2, left-hand side of the page, the middle of that side of the page. Tanu Rabbanan, we have a baraita. Kasher Yetzer Hara. The Yetzer Hara is so difficult. Shafilu Yotzro Kra'o Ra. That even its creator called it evil. Who is its creator? God, okay? God, for whatever mysterious reason, created human beings with a Yetzer Hara and a Yetzer Tov. An inclination to do evil and an inclination to do good. But the Yetzer Hara is so tough that even God said it's awful. And we have a quote from the scriptures here, from the book of Genesis, Shenemar, Ki Yetzer Lev Adam Ran Min Urav. For the inclination of a person's heart is wicked, Min Urav, from his youth. Yeah, that God said that about just his observation, this is the story after the flood. This is what God said about the Yetzer. Amar Rav Yitzchak, Yitzro shel Adam mitchadesh alav b'chol yom. Rav Yitzchak says a person's Yetzer renews itself every day. That is to say, you would think the Yetzer would get tired out. Most of the rest of us gets tired out. We have a goal, and over time we just lose interest in that goal. The Yetzer every day gets a good night's sleep. The Yetzer every day is ready to go and do his stuff as fresh tomorrow as he was the day before. Never flags. Never. Yitzor shel Adam mitchadesh alav b'chol yom. It becomes new in him every single day. Shenemar, rak ra kol hayom. It is only evil kol hayom. Not only hayom, but kol hayom. Every single day. Every single day. V'amar Rabbi Shimon ben Levi, Yitzro shel Adam mitgaber alav b'chol yom u'mivakesh lahamita. A person's Yetzer manages to overpower him every day and seeks to kill him. Seeks to kill him. Okay, that's the nature of the Yetzer. The Yetzer always is going to get you. Shenemar tzofer hashala tzadik u'mivakesh lahamita. The verse says, the wicked one looks toward the tzadik and seeks to kill him. Right? Who is the wicked one, of course? The Yetzer. The il malei HaKadosh Baruch Hu ozro ein yecholo. And were it not for the fact that the Holy One, blessed be He, helps a person fight against his Yetzer, we'd never be able to survive him. The Yetzer is much too competent. He's able to get everybody. And he does it again and again. Shenemar, as it says, Hashem lo ya'azvenu biyado. The Lord will not leave him in his hand, namely in the hand of the Yetzer. Now, the psychology here is really very interesting. Just to say a few words about psychology. Solomon Schechter, in his study of rabbinic literature, has a long section on the notion of the Yetzer. Schechter was writing this in the beginning of the 20th century when Freudian psychology was becoming popular. And he analyzes the Yetzer as crucial in terms of what he calls rabbinic anthropology. That is to say that there is a notion of the way in which human beings are constituted, and that notion is in its own way rather psychologically sophisticated. That is to say that human beings are pulled in different directions, and that, in fact, every human being has a tremendous amount of bad stuff, of stuff that's going on. That's not the whole story, but it's a powerful piece of the story. In classical Freudian psychology, one of the innovative thoughts there is the extent to which it is assumed that there are urges that are essentially evil urges. And those urges come from a variety of places and can be understood in terms of instinct. Some of it is just pure instinct. Some of it may come from environmental sources. But in fact, the whole notion that the human being is pushed by these urges, which are so very instinctual, and if not instinctual, at least one can say unconscious. Or maybe not entirely unconscious, but just about at the threshold of consciousness. That's what you have in rabbinic psychology 2,000 years ago. That's what we're reading about here. So it's certainly not the only possibility. I mean, you could believe that human beings, let's say, are predestined. That the nature of God's relation to the human being is that human beings just follow a divine plan, and that divine plan is written into something. You know, we would talk of it in terms of genes, but in a pre-modern period of time, they would say just God controls everything that there is, and human beings are in effect like puppets with a divine puppeteer. So that's a kind of psychology, actually. It's a psychology that takes away a great deal of human freedom, but it's a very popular psychology. This rabbinic psychology is much closer to modern psychology, I think. That is to say that human beings have a lot of things going on. And in fact, you need to recognize all those things, so many of which are negative. But there is as well the possibility of controlling them. So there is some framework of control. We wouldn't actually call it rational control necessarily, but a piece of it is certainly rational. We'll see the nature of the control, and I think you can guess what that is. It has to do with the Torah. The Torah exists in order to give a person the ability to fight against the Yetzer Hara. Okay, any questions or comments on that? Yes.
Maybe we have discussed this previously, but if we think the Yetzer Hara is created by God as part of some, what was the reason for creating it?
Well, that's the rabbis wonder that too. You know, that's not in this Masechet, it's elsewhere in the Talmud. The Talmud asks that question, because the Talmud says, you know, if it's such a problem, why did he do it? Why did he do it? And the way the Talmud puts it, it tells the following story. After the destruction of the first temple, the rabbis recognized that the Yetzer HaAvodah Zorah had been conquered. Now, let me say what that means. Realize that in the prophets, in the prophetic literature of the Bible, in a way, a modern person reads that, and it's a little hard to understand, because the temptation for people is the worship of idols. Truth is, I honestly don't think that that's our greatest temptation. I mean, you know, you just don't, there aren't that many idols around, and it's not really a big problem for most Jews. Unless we metaphorize it. We say, well, it's not really an idol, but the idol means money, or the idol means some non-spiritual thing, whatever it is. But if you go to these, there are a lot of countries in this world that have idols. You go to the Far East, go to India, go to Thailand, go to China, and you see the civilizations that, in fact, I remember being in Thailand, and every corner there's an idol. Every single corner. You go walk to the corner and there's an idol there. The people live with idols. And the idols are very important parts of their lives. I've never seen that before. I just always thought of these things as metaphors, not as really idols. So anyway, by the time of the destruction of the first temple, that whole experience during the prophetic period was so devastating to the people, and the reality of the Babylonian destruction was so horrendous, that it did produce a good result. One, the good result was that the people lost the yetzer for idolatry. They didn't have that anymore. So the rabbis in the Talmud said, at that point, it's early Talmudic period, they say, we got a good one going, let's get rid of the yetzer entirely. So they prayed to God that he should finish the job. Because the other big yetzer is sex. Sex makes the world go round. And it really, for better or for worse, let's say. I mean, it creates a number of complicated realities, to say the least. So the rabbis pray. And they think they're getting the answer to their prayer. And they said, this is wonderful. Suddenly, there's no yetzer. And after 2 days, the rabbi's wife says, would you go get some eggs from the chicken? They go out and look for the eggs for the chicken. And there are no eggs. There are no eggs. So another 2 days go by and they wait to get the eggs, figure the chicken is slow. There are no eggs coming out of the chickens. So they said, what happens? And suddenly the chickens are not producing eggs. You got rid of the yetzer. And the yetzer produces the eggs. And without the eggs, there are no chickens. And without the chickens, there are no people. And without the yetzer to bring the people to procreate, there will be no humanity.
Didn't know that chicken can give eggs without sex?
Chickens don't know that.
We didn't know that.
The chickens are all set for sex, and we introduce birth control into their lives. That's us. That's human beings. But that's the issue.
The answer for troublemakers.
So eventually the rabbis changed their prayer, and instead they asked not for to get rid of the yetzer, but to put blinders on the yetzer. And that's the prayer that was answered by God, and God was willing to put blinders on the Yetzer. So the Yetzer couldn't look here and he couldn't look there, but you have to remember to put the blinders on. Of course, the blinders are the rabbinic tradition. That is the tradition of rabbinic law. And that is, according to the rabbis, the desirable end is to control the Yetzer and not to get rid of the Yetzer. It's a major problem in the history of religion. Most religions, in fact, try to get rid of the Yetzer because they realize the problem. It's true in the Catholic, what is a priest? The priest has got to be celibate.
Three monkeys.
Right. I mean, it's the ideal in most faiths is to get rid of it. But the key thing is that in rabbinic literature, that was abandoned. And that was not seen as wise. and rather control of inclinations is the purpose of religious faith. Now you'll see that coming up right here. Look at this next. Wait, hold on just a minute till we get to this. Tana deve Rabbi Ishmael. The school of Rabbi Ishmael taught. Bini, im pagabecha menuval zeh. My son, if this repulsive one meets you, meaning the Yetzer Hara, if he bangs into you, if he touches you, moshchehu levet migdash, pull him to the house of study. Im even hu nimoach, if he is like stone, he will melt. The im barzel hu mitpotzetz, and if he is like iron, he will explode. Sheneamar halo koach devari ka'esh ne'um Hashem. Though my word has the power of fire, saith the Lord. Uchafatish yefatzei tzela, and like a hammer that breaks up a stone. Im even hu nimoach, if a stone he will dissolve. Sheneamar hoy kol tzamei lechu lamayim. Everyone who is hungry, everyone who is thirsty, should go to water. Now, of course, water means Torah here. Everyone who is thirsty, who needs, has spiritual needs, should be drawn to the Torah, which is spoken of as water. Ve'omer, and it says, Avanim shachaku mayim. Water is able to destroy, to wear down rocks. That's the power of water. And of course, water is the Torah. So the Torah is able to have that power, working slowly but steadily to create the Grand Canyon, as it were, to be able to cut away at the things that might otherwise seem impenetrable. But water is able to do that. So this is the famous statement, Im pagabecha menuval zeh moshchehu levet midrash. And the Hebrew is good. I don't know whether this translation does it justice. The repulsive one. A menuval means, how do you say it? Repulsive is not bad, but it's more picturesque than that. Menuval is like an umlal. It's like a person who's...
A bad person.
So it's ugly and unkempt and...
Grotesque
and all of those things put together. If he meets you, if that one runs into you, pick him up and take him to the Beit HaMidrash. That's the key thing. Now, I remember Professor Heschel, we had a course once in the Kutzke Rebbe. He wrote what turned out to be two books in the Kutzke Rebbe, one in English and one in Yiddish. And every time I read this piece of Talmud, I never forget what he taught us, what the Kutzke Rebbe said. He said, the Kutzke Rebbe taught this piece of Talmud in the following way. You've heard the way I've taught it, okay? If you beat this menuval, take him to the Beit HaMidrash, because the Beit HaMidrash will wipe him out. It'll knock him and give him a one two. The Kutzke Rebbe said, that's not what it means at all. Kutzke Rebbe says, if you meet this menuval, take him to the Beit HaMidrash, because that's where he'll have a lot of friends. He'll have a lot of friends.
Don't take care of him.
Right. He's very lonely, and what he needs is a lot of other people who go to shul. And in the shul, everybody gets to the shul, and what do? They talk about their business, and they talk about Lashon Hara. And when they're by themselves, they don't do that. But when they get together with their friends, then they do all of the things, and the Yetzer Hara says, oh, now I'm at home again. That's the way the Kutzke Rebbe interpreted this piece of Talmud. Okay, a radically different interpretation. Any questions so far? Bubba, you had a question.
I was going to say that the Yetzer Hara seems to be, I mean, It's almost like the cartoon where you've got the angel on one side and the devil on the other side, and they're like arguing and pulling the person this way and that way. And I guess the cartoon got it from this, but it's like a real visualization of this. But then when it says that he wants to kill you, that kind of, I mean, first it's a part of the person and it's an inclination, but then it's a separate entity that's capable of murdering the person that it's part of. So I think it's a kind of a mixed image in terms of whether or not this is autonomous or whether this is controlled by the individual.
Yeah, I think you're right.
It's kind of a mixed,
I think you're right.
I think it's not a clear kind of image.
I feel,
it seems to me this is all about, this is all the Hollywood plots that are, that have been around forever. It's all about this.
Yeah, you're right, you're right. I mean, this is...
And the bad guy dies
in the end. Hopefully. The old films, anyway. The old ones. Here you go. Okay, yes.
Note 22 says that God created the evil inclination to benefit man by giving him the opportunity to overcome his evil desires and thereby gain eternal rewards.
It's one way of looking at it. I gave you the more Talmudic answer, and this is a later kind of, let's say, more kosher orthodoxy. Okay.
Is there implied here when it says he wants to kill you? Does it mean kill you physically in this world, or somehow affect your situation in the Olam Haba?
Probably the latter, although I wouldn't count out the former. And I think that what you're talking about here is largely a spiritual death, but I don't think that they made that distinction as carefully as I've just made it, or as is implied in your statement. I think that essentially, yes, we're in the final analysis, it's life in the world to come. It's the immortality of the soul. But even before that, you know, you can be living a living death. You can be living a living death.
I'm wondering about whether the status of equalization between the good and the bad, does it play a role here which is not mentioned?
Say more. I don't follow.
The equalization of status between angel and Satan, for example, mm-hmm. is missing. It is not discussed either pro nor con.
Well, it is true that you don't see any discussion of the plus side. The only thing we've seen is the minus side. The only I have had discussion of the Yetzer Hara here. And frankly, there is much more discussion in the Talmud of Yetzer Hara than Yetzer HaTov. Because that's why you have a religious tradition. More than to bring you to the Yetzer HaTov, it's to fight the Yetzer Hara. Evil is considered to be a much bigger problem than good. And therefore, religion really has to deal with the problem of evil. And it's just so classic for us, too. The, you know, people will, even in our own day, I mean, we see this, we've seen it over the last while, I think the last year, we've seen it just so, in several extraordinary cases, of people who are taken to be very good, and who turn out to be very bad. And part of the reaction is, how could that be? You know, how could that be? It just doesn't make any sense. But rabbinic psychology is, I told you so, you know, everybody is like that. Everybody is like that, and if you think that somebody is not like that, you're living in an illusion, and you just have to be very wary of yourself, first of all. And hopefully the community has a strong sense of where it's going, because it needs the Torah.
Is there a separate judgment put on people who pretend to be more
righteous,
better, or righteous, yep. or more God-fearing, or more devoted to Torah, who then are you know, hiding behind that? Is there
the higher you are, the further you fall.
Yeah, but I'm saying
in the rabbinic tradition.
Yeah, but I mean, is it dealt with in?
Not in this, not in the right here, but yes, that is mutatis mutandis, but with roughly that language, you have that discussed in the Talmud, yes. Okay, yeah.
Is Yetzer Hara here always belong to our group of Jewish people, or the Menuval, or the Yetzer Hara can be non-Jew in the community?
That's an interesting question. In this context, it's only spoken of in terms of us. But I do think that it is understood to be a basic human characteristic. It's human. It's not a particularly Jewish characteristic.
How do we deal in a community? I understand I will take you to Beit HaMidrash, but I will deal with...
The Gentile?
The Gentile in my right. neighborhood.
That's why the Gentile needs these Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach. There are Noahide commandments, which are the commandments of the Gentile, and the Gentile has, to some extent, some of the same issues. And I think it's true. It's true. We share an awful lot of these things. They're simply the human condition. These are matters of the
That's
human condition. And to the extent that there is something to be learned from our own tradition, part of that tradition applies to the Gentiles as well.
After all, we are the elder brothers.
Yes, we are. Okay. Okay, now we're up 30b3. We leave this subject and we go back to the original Baraita. You remember the Baraita? This was the... If you want to look at it, it's 29a2. So we started the year. Tnina laha detanu rabbanan. Ha'av chayav bivno. Father is obligated with respect to his son, lemulo v'liftoto lamdo Torah, to circumcise him, to redeem him, to teach him Torah. And that's what we have been dealing with, really. The way this chapter is constructed, we've been following each of those requirements that come out of the Baraita. And that's what we, the last one was to teach him Torah. And that's how we got into the discussion of the Yetzer Hara, was because of Torah. The Torah is the antidote. And the next one is Ulahasi O Isha, and then Ulalamdo Manut. To marry him off to a wife and to teach him Omanut, a craft. The Yesh Omrim Aflahashito Bamayim. There are those who say to teach him even how to swim. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Rabbi Yehuda says, anyone who does not teach his son a craft has taught him listut, which is banditry. Taught him how to be a robber. And then the Gemara says, listut, sakadatach, you really mean a robber? And then it answers, ela ke'ilu malamdo listut. It's as if he taught him to be a robber. If you don't teach a child a profession, somehow he'll have to have money anyway. And so he'll have to resort to something unseemly in order to be able to have what he needs. Okay, so that's the Baraita, and we're picking it up now with Lahasi Oisha. Father is required to take a wife for his son, to see to it that his son marries. Minalan, where do we know this from in the scriptures? Dichtiv kechu nashim v'holidu banim. Marry wives and give birth to children. Banim uvanot, give birth to sons and daughters. Ukhu livnechem nashim, and take for your sons wives. Ve'ed benotechem tenu la'anashim, and your daughters you shall give to their husbands. Okay? So in other words, the parent has an active part in that process. Bishlama beno biyado. So the Gemara then says, well, this is makes sense as far as the father marrying off his son. Beno biyado, because the son is in his power, as it were. That is to say, behind this is the assumption that a man will, correct or not, I'm not saying that it's a correct assumption, but behind this is the assumption that men go out and find wives, that men are motivated, that they do the active part in finding a wife. There is some truth to this, but it's not as true as one might think, I think. If that is so, then...
For themselves or for their children?
Excuse me?
That men go out and find a wife for themselves.
For their children.
For, the children.
For their children. For their sons.
Right.
For their sons. You couldn't say that the same way for your daughter, because the assumption is that the son... That the man is going to be coming looking for your daughter. So you're not in the active, you're in the passive role, as it were. You're in the passive role. So that's the question the Gemara raises, and then the Gemara answers it by saying, Hachi kamar laho, this is what the prophet told them, Nitan la bi mide velavshaya unechasya. What it means is that the father should give her some of his possessions, and he should see that she is well clothed, and that she is covered, assuming covered beautifully. In other words, the father should share his wealth with his daughter, because if his daughter, part of that is the presentation of the daughter, and the fact that he makes her more attractive in a variety of ways, partly by sharing his wealth with her. Okay?
That doesn't refer to a dowry at all?
Yes, it may indeed refer to the dowry. Either directly or indirectly, this is referring to the dowry. I also think it refers to just creating the environment, we would say, to make sure she's beautiful. And the way I said it is to create the environment for that, you know, to right. encourage
facilitate
it,
things.
To facilitate it, right. Because that will be important in her suitability in the marriage market. Okay? Next is Lelamdo Umanut, to teach him a craft. Minalan Amar Chizkiah. Where do we know that from scriptures that a father is required to teach his son a craft? De'amakra, for scripture says, Re'e chayim im isha asher ahavta. See life im isha, with a woman whom you love. Interesting. That's a verse from
Kohelet.
There's a goodness in living a life with a woman that you love. Right? This is not only a modern idea, this is the Bible. And the way it introduces it is Re'eh Chayim. And the overtone of that is almost as it is in English. Life means a livelihood. So you should see a livelihood with a woman that you love. Man has to have a livelihood. Man has to have responsibility in order to be able to provide. And that is a basic requirement. Im isha mamashi, and there are two ways of interpreting this verse. With the woman that you love, perhaps means what it says. That is to say, it means a woman. Right? In that case, im isha mamashi, if we're referring here in the verse to a woman, a real woman, kashem shechayav lahasiyo isha, just as one is obligated to take a wife for his son, kachayav lelamdo omanut. So a person is required to teach him a profession, a craft. Im torahi, it is possible that wife is used as a metaphor there. And it doesn't mean a wife, but wife means the Torah. That you should love the Torah. So if it, in this case it means the Torah, Kushem Shechayav Lelamdo Torah, just as he is required to teach his son Torah, Kach Chayav Lelamdo Umanut. So it is important for him to teach his son an Umanut. Chayim. You have to have the source of Chayim. Okay? V'yesh omrim af lahashito banar. And there are those who say also to teach him how to swim in the river. The Gemara then says, my Tama, why do you have to do that? What's the reason for the Baraita to require that? Chayutehu. It keeps him alive. Namely, it's a life skill. That if, God forbid, a person would fall in the river, if he doesn't know how to swim, he'll drown. And therefore, it is a basic skill that the father is required to teach the child. Okay?
That was unusual. Apparently, historically, very few people knew how to swim.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Well, you see, the Talmud, you're required to learn how to swim.
Yeah, in France, in like 1800s and the 1700s.
They didn't know how to swim.
Didn't know how to swim, yeah.
Well, we were ahead of our time, ahead of the times.
They didn't go to camp.
That's right. That's a good line. All Jews were in camp in the summertime. So.
This thing about swimming, is that, do you personally feel that's common knowledge among Jews?
I think so. Well, no, I would say it's second nature to Jews because, as we said, Jews go to camp.
Right.
Really,
that's
it's no joke.
No, I'm sure.
But it's no joke. In sort of a folk culture where people don't know Talmud, they still do some of these same things. You know, Jews value education even if they don't know any Talmud. It may not be Jewish education, but you ever see a Jewish parent who doesn't want the child to get an education? You know, so there's a certain way in this in which this stuff is percolated.
Yeah, I understand. I mean, I went to camp when I was 3.
There you go.
Started learning how to swim, but it wasn't until I had a niece and I went online, because I'm her godmother, and I looked up, you know, the duties of a godmother, and Jewish, which is not a real thing, I know, but, and it says, teach
them
how
to swim.
And I told my brother, who's the father, he said, I never knew that. And we all grew up, you know, in a very Jewish home, never heard that before.
Do Hasidim have an emphasis on swimming?
Yes, it was very interesting, actually. That's one of the reasons why there are Hasidic summer camps. It actually got this fascinating. If you ever really want to read a wonderful book, I know I've recommended it before, Chaim Grada's book, The Yeshiva. It's 2 volumes translated into English. It was written originally in Yiddish. I don't think it was called that. As I know, the Hebrew version is called Tzemach Atlas. Tzemach Atlas is the hero of the book. Grada grew up in Eastern Europe between World War I and World War II. And this is the story of that period of time in Eastern Europe. And it's just an unbelievable story. But one of the things that it does is it brings you into the yeshiva world. Most of us don't have entree into the yeshiva world of Eastern Europe in the beginning of the 20th century. And it's not really like the yeshiva world of today. And one of the interesting things that I learned in that book is that in the yeshiva world, it was very important for people to swim. And to swim. The rivers were very important. There were a lot of rivers in Poland and Russia. And people would go down, and they particularly valued that type of recreation. And I had no idea. So I think there is a history to it. And there's this Talmudic, that's a basic piece of Talmud. Okay. Doesn't it feel like it got colder in here
it's
since
freezing.
That thing went on? Does anybody know how to turn that thing off?
Well, I think there's a window.
Turn it on.
The window
yeah.
open?
No. Yes, I cracked the window just a little bit for those of us who are asthmatic.
Yeah.
Not sit here with no air
flow. I think that I think the air conditioning went on.
Isn't that what that sound is?
Well, I was hoping it was heat. the same system can.
Yeah,
can,
but the heat is coming by the walls down.
Well, our system is a dual system. It does both. Heat comes supposedly from both places. That didn't feel like heat to me. Okay. Yes, Ari.
So over the centuries, then, most Jewish communities would be near some sort of water if they followed the scriptures in order to teach swimming. If you were inland, there could be no water anywhere around.
Well, I don't really know. I mean, in inland places, of course, you have rivers and you have lakes. So the European experience, it was rivers and lakes. It was not being on the ocean. It's always an issue. And to this day, in Israel, it's very interesting. And I remember I was always surprised to see the extent to which people from the yeshiva world, Hasidim and Misnagdim, were, and you'll see them, they're out on the trails. It's not... There certainly was a time, and it became famous through Chaim Nachman Bialik's poem, Hamatmid. Bialik wrote a poem which was devastating to the reputation of the yeshiva world. It was called the Matmid, the Masmid. The Matmid is a student who studied in the yeshiva around the clock. And he describes the student as being wan and weak and a person who never was under the sun. He was always studying. He was always studying. And that, realizing the history of Zionism, that Zionism was rebelling against that. The idea of going out and being strong and tan, all those were very important in Eastern European Zionism. And the yeshiva example, which was articulated by Bialik. I mean, Bialik was the poet of the alternative. That's very much a part of our consciousness. And I'm really not sure how true it is. Certainly it's somewhat true, but I'm really not sure how true it is. Because
he was also a doctor.
Bialik was? That I didn't know.
In our school, he was a school doctor.
Yes?
Yeah.
In our school, what do you...
Where I went to school.
Where did you go to school?
That was in Tel Aviv.
Oh, you went to that school in Nevet Tzedek?
No, it was not in Nevet Tzedek.
No? So Bialik was teaching in your school?
Not teaching. He came by
he was a
to
doctor.
Check the health of the students, so to speak.
Wow.
Oh. Interesting. Did you know that he was a doctor?
Yeah. Does anyone tell work to someone he liked?
He did this, you know, and all the cheekbones were hurting.
By the way, Bialik's house
has... You're privileged, my God. Can I touch your cheek?
You didn't like him.
I'm sorry, I'm very jealous.
Yeah, he touched by Bialik.
Bialik's house has just been opened again. It was refurbished over the last few years, and was just opened a few weeks ago. I haven't been there yet, and I expect to go on my next trip. I'm going to go to see Bialik's house again. I was there several years ago, but they've restored it to the way it was during Bialik's lifetime. Apparently what I saw several years ago was a stripped-down version in order to make it look nice for modern people, but they've restored it to the way it was during his lifetime, and I just saw pictures of it, and it's just amazing. It's gorgeous. Well worth a visit.
Where is it?
Right downtown Tel Aviv. It's
off Allenby Street.
It's off right behind Bogoroshov Street. Bogoroshov Street. It's right downtown Tel Aviv. Right downtown. It's a fantastic street because some of the greats lived on that street. City Hall was on that street for a while. And Reuven Rubin lived on that street, the great artist of that period of time. So it was an amazing group of people.
Come to think of it, I think Chernyakhovsky was a medical doctor.
Really?
That I kind of have a recollection of. Are we not confusing the two?
I don't know. That's,
I must admit my memory ain't what it used to be.
Well, we'll have to look it up.
Chernyakhovsky was a doctor.
But I think it was...
Bialik... All of them, by the way, any of you here at the lecture I gave to the Chevra Kadisha last year? I don't think any of you were at that lecture. I gave a lecture on, were you there? On the cemeteries?
Cemeteries.
My lecture on the cemeteries. One of the cemeteries was a cemetery on Rehov Trumpeldor. Trumpeldor, downtown Tel Aviv, where Chernikovsky is buried and Bialik is buried, and all the greats are there. It's one after another. It's all the great Zionists are in that cemetery. All the great Zionists and the poets and the writers and the composers, they're all in the same cemetery. Amazing place. Okay.
You know, you say downtown Tel Aviv. It reminds me, when I go downtown, you get off and there is a cemetery in Lower Manhattan.
Downtown? It's also a cemetery, correct. Okay, v'yesh omrim af la'ashito benar. There are those who say that you should teach him how to swim. We said, matama chayutahe. And then it goes on, Rabbi Yehuda says, kol she'eno milamdo omanut milamdo listut. Anyone who does not teach his son a craft teaches him robbery. Now the Gemara will ask about that. Listut salgadatach, that we had already seen in the Baraita. Does he really teach him robbery? Ela ke'ilu melamdo listut. No, it is as if he teaches him robbery. Now the Gemara asks an interesting question. It says, my benayhu, what is the difference between the two points of view that have been expressed? Namely, the Tanakama, the first teacher. The first teacher who said that, it was the one who says, lilamdo omanut, to teach him a craft. And then the second one who comes in and says that if you don't do that, you're teaching him listut. Gemara is assuming that there are two points of view here. That Rabbi Yehuda comes, and he adds something different. And listen to the answer. Ika benayhu da'agmara iska. The difference is whether it's enough to teach him iska. Now, iska means here what we would say in the most general terms, business. But what it means is business where you're buying and selling, where you're engaged in buying and selling. Because the question is whether that's a decent enough way to make a living, or whether the force of omanut is what we would translate as a profession. You know, it's a craft, yes. So either it's some sort of craft, or in modern terminology, we make a distinction between business and the professions. And the professions, are here understood in the broadest sense of the term. You know, that always there'll be a need for a doctor. I'm sure at least one of you has heard that from a mother. Or you've said it to a child. That there'll always be a need for a doctor. There'll always be a need for a lawyer. Okay? The good times and bad times. What?
Your lips to God's ears.
That is the opinion of Rav Yehuda. Rav Yehuda is creating a further distinction here and saying it's not just that you teach him how to make a living, but it's the kind of a living that you make should be a living that is protected from the ups and downs that in fact affect many a living. So that there are lots of types of livings that are just, they can end up with listut, namely that they're too insecure. And as a result of that, one will have to resort to inappropriate things. So that's the distinction that is being made here according to the Gemara. Okay? So here too, it's a very old Jewish distinction between just making a living and then having a type of livelihood that's somewhat immune to the cycles of economies.
Everybody always needs a roof over their
head. You better believe it. Oh, here. It's another type of omanut.
What was that?
Everybody always needs a roof over their head.
Oh, that's the family business.
Okay.
What did Yehuda do for a living when he wasn't?
I don't know what he did. When he wasn't being a rabbi?
When he wasn't being a basi or whatever.
I don't know. Well, this is Rabbi Yehuda. Is Rabbi Yehuda Bar Ilai? That's not Rabbi Yehuda Nasi. That's different. This is Rabbi Yehuda Bar Ilai.
Iska, you translated it as doing business, but Iska could be like Isuk, which is Omanut.
Omanut is art.
No, what do you mean? Omanut is a profession.
Yeah, correct. That's where I was going with this,
right,
to understand it as a profession.
Right.
As a profession, correct. Okay, very good. Let's keep going. Now, at this point, we are actually going back to the Mishnah, which was the very first Mishnah at the beginning. All right, here we go again.
Nice. Before it was off.
There was no heat for last period. There's been no heat.
Or no air conditioning.
At Columbia the other day, when it was, what, 20 degrees out, my office was 50 degrees.
50 degrees.
They were pumping air conditioning.
That's not good.
How lucky can you get, Laura?
I know. I'm so lucky.
I would complain to the management.
But that's Columbia.
Okay. Go back to the Mishnah on page 29A1. This to refresh our memories. Kol mitzvot ha-ben ala av, anashim chayavim, v'nashim peturot. All of the obligations of the son upon the father. And the very first question we asked in the Gemara was, what does that mean? And we learned that what it meant was the things that the father is required to do for the son, such as to circumcise. Right? In that case, the father is required, the mother is not required. Right? The father is required, the mother is not required. So, anashim chayavim v'nashim peturat. The next piece of the Mishnah is, the chol mitzvot ha'av al ha-ben. It's the opposite. The first one was, chol mitzvot ha-ben al ha'av. All of the mitzvot of the ben, of the son, on the father, that meant that the father is required for the son. This is the opposite now. Chol mitzvot ha'av al ha-ben. That is to say, all of the mitzvot that a son is required to do for the father. Right? In that case, over to the next page. Echad anashim v'echad nashim chayavim. There's no distinction between men and women. There's no distinction between men and women. Okay? So, we will be focusing on that now, and this is going to lead to a long discussion in the Gemara about some of the mitzvot that in fact are obligatory on sons and daughters toward their parents. So these are the mitzvot of children toward their parents. Okay?
So av means av va'im?
Correct, because of the second piece of the Mishnah, it means Avayim. My kol mitzvot avalabein. What is meant by all the obligations of the father upon the son? Ile makol mitzvata de mechayev ablemev ad livrei. If it were to mean all of the mitzvot that a father is required to do for his son, nashim chayavot. Are women required to do that? No, we learned in the first part of the Mishnah that they're not. Ve'atanya ha'av chayav bivno lemulo v'liftoto. We learned in the Baraita that a father is required to circumcise his son and to redeem his son. Aviv ein, the father, yes. Imo lo, not the mother. Okay, that we had learned earlier on. Amar Rav Yehuda therefore says, Hachi kamar. This is what the Mishnah means. Kol mitzvot ha'av amutelet al ha-ben. All of the mitzvot concerning a father which are literally cast upon the child. That is to say, the mitzvot that a child has toward the father, la'asot la'aviv, to do for his father. Echad anashim v'echad nashim chayavim. Both men and women are equally obligated. Tnina laha de tanu rabbanan. We have learned in our Mishnah the same thing that the rabbis taught. And here, now we're going to go into the details of the mitzvah of kibud av v'em. Honor thy father and thy mother. And there is a cognate mitzvah, which is ish imo v'aviv tirao. A man should revere his mother and his father. Honor your father and your mother, and revere your mother and your father. Those are the two mitzvot that are connected with each other. What's the question?
The difference between honor and revere.
Oh, we'll get to that. That's what the Gemara is going to be about. Well, that's what you have to read the Talmud for. You have to read the Talmud to find that out. That's what the subject of the Talmud is. You're ahead. You figured out what they're wondering about.
What is the word in Hebrew for revere?
Yud Resh Aleph. Yare. Is to fear. To fear.
Lo ira.
Lo ira. Lo ira rak yatami imadi. Yes.
What is the duty of the mother on the daughter, if any?
What is the duty of the mother on the daughter? Well, that we're not dealing with here. Let's just deal with this first. Okay?
It seems to me women don't count.
I wouldn't say that. This is all going to be about women. And it's being 50% about women and 50% about men. So I wouldn't. How do you say that? Okay.
I thought that at least in the Orthodox tradition, a woman can't say Kaddish for her father. It doesn't count if a woman says Kaddish for the father. It has to be the son.
Correct.
So that's not consistent with this, or not.
Well, we don't know what it means to honor. You're presupposing that honor means saying Kaddish.
Oh, I thought, isn't that one of the mitzvot?
Nope. No. You will see the Gemara is going to ask very specifically what is meant by honor. And it will be very explicit to define that.
When are they going to ask?
What?
So when will they get around?
Well, if we ever can get there.
It was a subtle way.
Thank you. Tanina laha de tanu rabbanan. We learned in our Mishnah the same as what the rabbis learned in the Baraita. Ish, when it says Ish imo v'aviv tirao, every man you shall revere your... Wait a second. That's an incorrect translation. It's Ish imo v'aviv tirao. Every man shall revere his mother and his father. Ein li ela ish. From here I know only that a man is required to revere his parents. It says ish, imo v'aviv tirao. It says ish, which means a man. Right? Isha minayin, how do I know a woman? How do I know that a woman is also required to revere her parents? Kishu omer tirao. The verb is plural. The verb is you in the plural, tirao, as a vav at the end.
But a singular subject.
And it has a singular subject. So the word man, in fact, doesn't always mean man, as it used to mean in English. I mean, it used to be that in English, man would mean man and woman.
Yeah, one.
Yeah, but until there was the need to decide that it didn't mean that, that you had to say man if you meant man, and woman if you meant woman. It used to be man meant both. Men and person. So here is the same thing. Ish imovi aviv tirao. The word man can mean both man and woman, and the fact that it's in the plural implies that it means both of them. Kishu omer tirao hare kan shnayim. The fact that it's in the plural refers to two. What are the two? Men and women. So both men and women are required to revere their parents.
May I ask a question?
Yeah.
I always understood the word ish was an adult versus a na'ar.
That's correct.
So isn't it interesting that this commandment is addressed to adults?
You will see that. Generally speaking, most of the understanding, the discussion here in the Talmud has nothing to do with children. The honor your father and your mother has to do with adult children honoring and revering their adult parents.
Very nice, because it lets children off the hook a little bit.
Well, because children in every case are considered to be educable. You have to educate children to become adults. And that is true in the area of honoring parents, as it is in every other area. But most people think that honor your father and your mother is directed at little children. Well, it is directed... It is,
I didn't have exclusive. Yeah.
It is, in fact, directed at adult children. Okay?
I think that there's no need for this parsing of this tirao makes it plural, because the usage of the word ish, the way it's phrased here, is usually, has always been, then and now, a kind of a generalization. It's not ish, it's like saying everyone, which means plural. Everyone should...
But there could be circumstances where it could mean men.
No, I think...
It doesn't always mean both.
It's the usage
of... Yeah, but they like to discuss the difference. They always...
It's the usage of this kind of... The word ish and this kind of usage.
I think the parsing is good.
Not bad, but I'm saying that that's how the word ish is.
It's like everyone.
Maybe because this... Maybe with the fact that we understand it to be that way is because of what we're reading. 2,000 years later, we're used to it.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. In Cain, matamod lomar ish. Why then does it say ish? It could have used yet a more general term, like Adam. Okay. So why does it then use the word ish? Ish sipek biyado la'asot, ishar en sipek biyado la'asot. The assumption is that there may be circumstances where a woman may be limited in terms of her ability to deliver some of the services to the parent because she has a conflicting obligation toward her husband. And if there would be a conflict, in fact, her primary obligation is to the husband and not to the parent. So it says.
I can't see where. I can understand it, but I can't see it.
What do you mean you can't see it? It could be that a woman's husband will say to her, "You don't do this. You're not allowed to do the following." Many societies, men have that control over their wives. Do we then say that she is guilty of not honoring her parent? Do we blame her for it? The answer is no, because they understood that she might be in a position of lacking power to do what otherwise she should be doing, and you can't hold that against her. Whereas he is not likely to be in that position, and therefore you can hold it against him. You see? Go ahead, Francis.
How do I express it? I understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
But I don't see why the difference, why the distinction.
The distinction is one, it's not saying that it has to be that way. Right. It is saying the reality is that women, certainly in their time, were in a much more compromised position of power.
Right.
They had much less ability to express their own power and their own desires. In that case, we can't hold it against them if there's a mitzvah that they cannot, even though they're obligated by the mitzvah. Because we're saying here that women are equally obligated. So we're saying that, yes, that's true, but you know, we allow for the possibility, if she can't do it, it's not held against her.
A Jewish slave is limited to honor his parents?
A Jewish slave also has to honor the parents, yeah.
So he's like a woman.
That's true. Yep. You're quite right. That's a good analogy, actually, because the slave is much like a woman, as far as rights and obligations, go. Not exactly, though. It's not exactly. It's still different.
Was there a customary living arrangement at this time? Was it customary for the wife to come and live with the husband's family, the husband to live with the wife's family, or did they set up separate housekeeping completely?
I don't know. I assume that they did not set up separate housekeeping, but I don't know who lived with whom. I don't know whether it was clear that... my hunch is it went with the husband's family, but I don't know.
The first Mishnah talked about the Bia. He takes her to his house.
Right.
I don't know whether that was simply for Kedushin or...
I would say that my sense is that she goes into his sphere. He doesn't go into her sphere.
That's implied in this.
Yes, I think that's implied in a lot of this. And therefore, in our terminology, it would mean that she and he live with his family to the extent that they're living with a family. I don't have a lot of proof for that, though, that in fact they lived with the family. Maybe we'll see some of that. Let's keep that in mind as we read this material, see whether we can sort of read into it a certain family structure. Okay, let's keep going. Okay, v'ne'emar. No, I've skipped. Keshua omer tira, matamud lamar ish sipek b'yadam, right, mipnei, shurashut acharim alea. She may be in the position of having the power of others over her. Okay, that's what we said. Amar Ravidi bar Avin Amar Rav nitgarsha shnehem shavim. If she becomes divorced, then of course they're equal once again. Namely, she has her obligations to her own parents. So, in the circumstance of marriage, there could be a compromise of that. But once that's, if that were to be compromised, the marriage itself were not to exist, then of course she has no long-term relations to his parents.
There's no commandment to love your parents. Just
no.
To fear them.
Correct. No, to honor them. To honor and to revere. The revere, I think, is a better term. You'll see why I use that term. But there is no commandment to love, no.
Maybe respect is a better term than fear.
That's why I used revere. I used the term revere. I think it has it has aspects of fear, and it has some aspects of love, but I don't think it's either of them. Okay?
There's nothing about the woman's obligation to children. I'm surprised. I would think that...
No, you know why? I have a theory for that. Do you know why there's no mitzvah for that? Because it doesn't have to be.
It's assumed.
It's assumed.
But, see, I would think that, you know, even if she's divorced... She may have young children that she has to give care to.
Yeah.
But she's now on an equal footing with the brother that doesn't have the young children. It's not breastfeeding, not doing all of that.
I don't understand.
Well, I mean, I'm thinking the practicalities of how this...
If she's divorced.
...is supposed to do that.
If she's divorced?
She should be divorced with young children.
Right.
And let's say her father needs her to come and cook for him or nurse him or things like that. But it now says, though, if she's divorced, she has equal responsibility with her brother, who's not a mother.
Is that what it says, right? No. That's not, I don't think that...
With regard to their obligation to their parents.
No, I don't think that means a brother. It just means that it doesn't... I don't think that that's the English translation put that in. That's not what it says. What it's saying is that simply we're saying that there is a distinction between men and women while a woman is married.
Right.
There is a problem that she faces, that she may have the hand of someone over her.
Right.
Once that is not the case anymore, shnehem shavim, namely males and females are exactly the same.
From the obligation.
So point. I say the same thing, but women do have obligations of children, and it's not an out in terms of... They don't have more leniency because they have children with regard to these parental obligations.
That is correct.
So I think that's interesting that was not given as leniency, but the realities of the social construct of
that's exactly right.
The needs of the husband and the demands of the husband are enough to change things. So that's interesting.
Correct. That's exactly right.
Because in those days, the son has had
has had the benefit of the father's obligation to teach him a craft. The woman does not have a craft, so she's not
she's
working.
She's dependent on that husband.
Right. Well, but she's not working. The husband is working.
Yeah, a lot of that has to.
Working at home.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No,
doesn't matter.
Right.
Yeah, but you're not earning.
Working at home is working with a lot of young children.
It's understood that he is working but has time to honor his parents. She is working in the home but has time. She's not working in the home and having a craft.
Yeah. No, I think that's fair.
She's financially dependent on the husband, and she can't make him upset.
But here she's divorced.
I mean, if she's divorced, the father is responsible for the children. The father still has the responsibility to pay for his children.
In this day and age, was there divorce?
Of course. Oh, yeah. Of course. I mean, that's what the Talmud says here. Nid karsha. If she got divorced.
Yeah, so,
it was a reality.
I think the other point we already mentioned is relevant too, which is if the woman's married, she's likely not living near enough for her parents to be of any use to them anyway.
Mm-hmm. It's also true. Correct. Tanu Rabbanan. Ne'amar kabed et avicha ve'et imecha, ve'ne'amar kabed et Hashem e'oncha. Two parallel biblical verses. It says, honor your father and your mother. And it says, honor the Lord from your substance, from your wealth. Okay? Hishva hakatuv kibud av ve'em lichvod ha-makom. The scriptures therefore equate the honor of God with the honor of parents. It's a very basic piece of Talmud. Mm-hmm. That the honor of parents is considered to be reflective of the honor of God. Okay? So central is it that the two of them are compared one with the other. Ne'amar ish imov yaviv tirau. It says, every man you shall revere your mother and your father. Ne'amar et Hashem Elokecha tirav otot avod. And it says, you shall revere the Lord your God, and you shall serve him. Right? Both God and the parents are spoken of similarly, in terms of reverence or fear. Hishva katuv mora'a avaim lemora'at hamakom. Scripture compares the reverence toward a father and mother to the reverence of God. Ne'amar umekalel aviv ve'imo mochumat. It says, one who curses his father and his mother should receive the death penalty. The Ne'amar ish ish ki yekalel Elohav v'nasacheto. Any person who curses God shall have to bear his sin. Namely, he gets the death penalty also. Hishva katu birkat av va'em. Scripture compares, now in Hebrew, you can't say in Hebrew to curse a parent. And you can't say to curse God. Both of them are on the same status. And so the way you say to curse God is Birkat Hashem or Birkat Avaim. To say the opposite. It's a euphemism. You say to bless them, and what you mean is the opposite. Because you're not, it's so terrible a thing that you can't say it in Hebrew. So it's fascinating here. Yishva katu Birkat Avaim li Birkat Amakom. It means the opposite of what it is saying. The scriptures compare the blessing of father and mother with the blessing of God. Aval bahaka avadai efshar. There is a difference, however, of course, with striking. You get the death penalty for striking a parent. You get the death penalty, but you can't get the death penalty for striking God. You know why? Because you can't strike God. There's no way to do it. Right, so they're different, the two of them. So it says it can't be the same. V'chein bedin sheshlosh, v'chein bedin, and this is all logical. Sheshlotan shutafim bo, for the three of them are partners in him. Namely, every child is the product of three partners, a father, a mother, and God. And therefore, the three partners are considered to be equal partners to the production of the child. So it's a very basic idea that, and this is the Talmudic source for it, that every child is the product of father, mother, and God. There are three partners. I always tell that when I have people come to see me, and they can't have a child. So there's a problem with infertility, and there's a husband and a wife, and the thing that I always remind people about is that there are three partners. There are three partners. And all three have to be active partners. And that there's a religious side to it that is equally important. Modern people don't think that way. They figure they have to go to a doctor. A doctor may be an important player, as in many things. You have to do certain things, perhaps medically. But there's a religious side to the production of children, which is central to our notion of the fertility of fertility and of having children, that God is an equal partner with the mother and the father.
Well, how does that apply, though? If they come to you with an infertility problem, what are they? I'm not sure I follow that.
Well, then,
what do they do about it?
First of all, they have to pray. You have to pray to God. That, and I must say, in my experience, I have had about as much success as most fertility doctors. I have found that most of the cases that I have gotten that have come to me, we've solved.
Really?
Yes. Most of the infertility problems, not all, but I would say that a rabbi's success rate is about as good as a doctor's.
So you say it's psychological?
No, not psychological. No way. It's theological. Theological. It's a theological. It's one of these things that goes beyond the normal. It goes to a level of the mystery. That one of the mysteries of existence is involved in this thing. So, I mean, I'm not discounting medicine. I think medicine is important and sometimes can solve problems that are very crucial. But I'm just adding another dimension, which is the theological dimension, because of this idea that we have that there are three partners in the creation. And that to the extent, therefore, that one has access to the third partner, one has to use all of that, all of the accessibility that's available, or else one is not really exploiting the situation as is appropriate.
Would this imply that a couple who or people who are have this problem have sinned somewhere against their parents?
No. Why? Why would it?
I'm
not at all.
Taking it logically.
No, I don't think there's a logical connection.
That prayer, that like a.
Nope. We don't know.
Repentance.
We'd have no idea how God runs the world. Certain cases, we have scriptural evidence that tells us you get this for that. But scripture never says that.
That's what it is.
Is there of respect and mitzvot to parents? Is there a tchum or a distance that a son can move away from the parents' location? That up to that distance he is obligated. If he moves to a different town or a different country, he is not obligated. I mean, what?
The answer is
no. Put any distance?
The answer is, you'll see more of this, but the answer is no.
Because you have an incentive.
So how somebody will move to another country or fulfill the
problem?
You have to come home and have a sister.
It's a problem.
You know, I had this problem when I moved to this country, and I said,
this
so my mother always say, you go there, you moved, God will help me. Don't worry.
You had a nice liberal mother who taught you that. Because I could imagine another mother said, you know, your obligation to your mother. Don't forget.
You're moving away from me.
You may have wanted to, but I can imagine a mother making you feel guilty about it. That was your mother. You are lucky.
I'm just curious. When you have these couples come you get them to pray, and they
he's an evangelist. She just hasn't told
them. But the you have the positive consequence that they bear children. Does that, is that usually accompanied also by an involvement in Jewish life and some other aspects of their life that that change other than that? Because I'm
yes.
thinking to myself,
yeah.
if all they do is come and they only pray just for one thing and they get that reward and they do nothing else, then that's almost mm-hmm. not justifiable.
Correct. You're right. You know, prayer is not so easy. It's really part of a larger context. And the truth is that that larger context is part of what makes increase, as I used the language before, of accessibility. The reality of accessibility to a realm of the divine doesn't happen just because you pay your money or you say your words. It's much more complicated. It's fair. Okay? But it's also, I don't want to say that it doesn't involve these sort of simple things also, but it is part of a larger context, of course. Good.
So would you classify it as a miracle or simply?
Every conception is a miracle. Every single one. When your babies were born, what do you think? Every single one is a miracle.
That's what I say. Every baby is a miracle.
Every baby
is a miracle.
Every baby is a miracle. You see a baby, and you see that baby, and it's as great a miracle as the creation of the world.
So then what happens over time to that wonderful miracle?
It's the Yetzirah. Yetzirah, where that's where we started.
Like when they intermarried.
I remember when I saw my babies, one of my reactions was, because I came out of this tradition, was that I had the opportunity to see somebody who had never sinned. That's one of the beautiful things about seeing the baby. The baby has no sin. And it's just an incredible thing.
And when does the Yetzer Hara come to the baby?
Well, slowly but surely. It doesn't happen all at once. I can tell you that by two, it's very strong.
It's very strong. You know, there's major studies about children and mothers now. And at 4 months old, a baby can already start to manipulate a parental.
There you go.
The Yetzer Hara comes the next day after the birth.
It probably comes very soon. Very soon. You're probably very, very right there. But there is a time when it's really pure. And it's a great thing to see. It's just an extraordinary thing. I have to tell you the story about the Israeli professor who was at Columbia. A professor of history, I won't mention his name, some of you may have heard of him. He was studying history, he was teaching history at Columbia. He used to eat in the seminary dining room when I was teaching full time. So his wife had a baby. And he came to lunch, and we're all sitting around, and he said, well, what was it like? He says, I can't tell you, it was just the most amazing thing, it was so incredible. There's just one problem. He said, what was the problem? He said, I almost believed in God. that was his issue. He was a secular professor of history, you know. He defined himself, you know, as a secular Jew, and he came really close.
What brought him for meals to the center?
He spoke Hebrew. Yeah, well, probably the food. It was a Yiddish kind of environment, you know. Okay. Very good, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure. To be continued.
About my own, you know, childhood. Ever since I came.